And you're on.
Okay. Well, welcome, everybody. Welcome to our May call. You know, it's so great to see everybody, knowing that a lot of you will actually see next month in D.C. And I'm very much looking forward to that. A lot of preparation has been going into it, and we're all very excited about what's going to happen there. I particularly also want to welcome the chapters that are brand new. So since last month's call, either these are brand new chapters or they've been relaunched, and I apologize for the pronunciation on some of these, but it includes Maroochydore in Australia, Norfolk, Virginia, Rochester, New York, Riverside, California, Bloomington, Minnesota, Chaska, Minnesota, Amherst, Massachusetts, Redding, California, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Wapaka, Wisconsin, Falls Village, Connecticut, and St. Cloud, Minnesota. And that is falls on top of 15 groups that started the month before. So it's so great to have the new chapters that are coming on and coming on at a continually high pace. In a moment, I'm going to be introducing our guest speaker. Some of you had the pleasure of seeing her at last year's conference. She was on our climate change and health panel last year in DC. And we were so excited about that. We asked if she would come on to be one of our monthly speaker also. I know you know quite a bit about the organization already, Dr. Desjarnais, but one of the things that you should know about is these people are always willing to step up to meet a challenge. So coming out of the election and last year and the beginning of this year, we really identified a couple of things that we thought were important. One is we needed to make a big statement at the conference and have a lot of people there. And right now there's 1,170 people registered, which is by far the most people we've ever had registered for a conference, and an additional 154 on the waiting list. So we asked everybody to make a statement. They did it. Secondly, in the absence of the leverage of the Clean Power Plan, we were looking to see where were there other places where we could exert leverage on the political process of getting a national carbon price. And we believe that in certain cases, states would make sense. So last Monday night, there was 115 Californians on a call about a piece of legislation in California that meets the criteria that we established as something that we would consider supporting. First of all, there needed to be an organization. There is one called CalFact that would be doing the work on it so that CCLs, when we're lobbying, it's always on federal legislation. But also then it had to meet four principles. One is a policy that would reduce emissions beyond existing policies. It would protect low-income people. It would be politically viable in that state, and that it could harmonize with national carbon fee and dividend or other state programs. So right now, California is considering SB 775, which would be an amendment, and we believe a significant improvement to the existing cap and trade program inside of AB 32. So it's just not unusual at all for our people to step up in that kind of way. And the people you're talking to are people who are always looking for a challenge and how they can meet it. Okay, our guest today, and again, as I said, she spoke last year at the conference, very, very well received. Dr. Natasha Desjarnais is a policy analyst in the American Public Health Association's Center for Public Health Policy. Her specialty areas within the policy center include climate change and environmental exposures. Dr. Desjarnais received her PhD in public health from the University of Louisville in 2013. As a postdoc at the university, she was awarded a fellowship by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences to investigate cardiovascular risks of air pollution exposures. Thank you so much for being our guest for the call today. And I'll turn it over to you. And I believe that Ricky will advance your slides.
Thank you so much, Mark. I really appreciated that kind introduction. Good afternoon, everyone from Upper Marlboro, Maryland, which is a suburb of Washington, D.C. I'm so honored to be presenting to this amazing group, the Citizens Climate Lobby, today. Many thanks to Drs. Lisa Del Bono and Dr. Lori Byron for inviting me. I'm Natasha Desjarnais. I'm a policy analyst at the American Public Health Association, and I lead our natural environment portfolio, which includes climate change, air, and water exposures. So today I'll talk about the links between climate change and health, and then I'll also share some of our helpful resources that we have for educating others on this connection. So before I dive into the relationship between climate change and health, I'd like to give you a little bit of insight on APHA as an organization. APHA is a global community of public health professionals and the collective voice of the health of the public. APHA's central challenge is to be the healthiest nation in one generation. We were founded in 1872, and we're a 501c3 nonpartisan organization. We have over 50,000 individual and affiliate members. So we're a membership organization. And our members are divided into sections, or specialty sections, we should say. So we have one for the law section. We have one for occupational health. We have one for epidemiology, maternal and child health, mental health. And then we also have a very active environment section. Within the environment section, there is a subcommittee called the Climate Change Topic Committee. Recently, they have expanded beyond the environment section so that now members from any section can participate in the conversation on climate change and health. And so it's wonderful. We now have, there's someone from the law section that's a co-chair. We also have epidemiology involved. And really, we think everybody needs to be at the table to address climate change. It's all hands on deck thing. So recently, we've started recently our members decided that our annual meeting theme would be climate change is health. So that's going to be this fall in Atlanta. APHA believes that to become the healthiest nation in one generation, we must address climate change. We believe that it is the greatest threat to public health today. And we understand that we are the first generation to experience the health impacts of climate change, but likely the last that can do something about it. So in the next slide, I'm gonna share with you a couple key outcomes of climate change and how it's impacting our health. I'm pretty sure everybody on the call understands that the burning of fossil fuels causes the release of carbon dioxide, which builds up in the atmosphere, trapping heat below, causing our Earth's temperature to rise, much like a blanket traps heat below, and that's climate change. But this extra trapped heat, it disrupts the interconnected systems in our environment. Those results have grave impacts on our health. So I'm just going to talk about a couple of those key aspects of climate change during this talk and how it relates to our health. I'll speak on air quality, extreme heat, extreme precipitation, flooding, and vector-borne disease. So in terms of air quality, climate change decreases the quality of the air we breathe. And air quality, having good air quality is a human right. It's a fundamental human right. We need it. We need it to breathe. So what we understand is that this climate change is increasing air pollution. This impacts people with asthma. This contributes to heart disease. In addition, climate change is creating longer warm seasons and hotter warm seasons. In addition, the buildup of carbon dioxide is actually creating more potent pollen. So that is just a recipe for disaster for allergies, for people with allergies and asthmatics. So we have longer and more intense allergy season due to climate change, decreased productivity at work, days off work, et cetera. And then for children, they're even more vulnerable to these asthma and allergy impacts of climate change. Then the condition of climate change leading to drought is causing wildfires, and this wildfire smoke is also decreasing the quality of the air that we breathe. And that's resulting in increased hospital visits for asthma and heart disease as well. And then we've also got issues with mold. That's an indoor air quality concern that results from flooding. So flooding to our homes, our jobs, our schools, decreases the quality of air there. And then that can trigger asthma and allergy responses as well. And then ultimately, when it comes to air quality, we know that people that live in places with worse air quality have higher risk of death. In fact, air quality follows that of life expectancy. Places with worse air quality have lower life expectancy. So air quality is a significant issue when it comes to climate change. Another important issue is extreme heat. So extreme heat can impact our health in many ways. As I said, we've got longer, hotter, warm seasons. We've got more heat waves, and this has grave impacts on our health because we have more heat-related illness. So that being heat strokes or heat exhaustion. And then there are people that are especially vulnerable to this. People with respiratory and heart diseases are more sensitive to the extreme heat. Then there are also vulnerable populations among children and the elderly. So those with extremes in age, very young or very old, they're also very susceptible to extreme heat. The children are outside playing in this extreme heat, and we've heard horrible cases of children that may fall victim to extreme heat, playing outdoors, having football practices on days that are just too extremely hot for it, or even having activities indoors on days that are extremely hot. And then elderly not being able to leave their homes on extreme heat days, or not knowing that it's important to leave their homes on extreme heat days, and suffering in this extreme heat, where they may have pre-existing medical conditions like cardiovascular disease, respiratory diseases that make them more susceptible. And ultimately, extreme heat can lead to death. Another key impact of climate change I want to share with you is extreme rainfall and drought. You've heard we're having, or you've experienced, I should say, these severe storms are becoming even more frequent, the flooding that results. The thing about extreme precipitation is it's both ends. So you'll have the extreme storms, the extreme rainfall, but you'll also have drought. Suppression of rainfall. Both of these have great impacts on our health as well. So with the severe storms, there might be injuries, there may be trees down, there may the accidents that result from this, and flooding that comes from that. And then the wildfires come because of the drought, as I described earlier, or the drought makes a conducive environment for wildfires to break out. On the news I heard today, there are 28 active wildfires in Florida as we speak. So it's happening now. The urgency is here, and the health impacts, we're experiencing it, and the mold that will result from flooding. The asthma and heart disease results from the air quality that's caused due to the wildfires and the flooding, for example. But what I really want to highlight here that often is not discussed in terms of climate change is the mental health outcomes. You see these severe storms, and it's great when people are able to evacuate safely. They actually fare better mentally. The sooner you evacuate and the further that you evacuate, you have better mental health outcomes. But you think about Hurricane Katrina's Superstorm Sandy, sometimes people are not able to relocate in times of storm, and it has grave impacts on our mental health. Post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety that results. We actually could have an entire call just speaking on mental health. It's far-reaching when it comes to climate change, and the extreme storms are one of the key links there. To what I've just shared on rainfall, I'll also share the health impacts of flooding. Many of the health, the threats to health are quite similar, but I want to talk about, so what happens with our floodwaters. It may be too much for our sewer system, so it overflows our sewer system, sending the sewer water straight out into the water supply. What's known about this is that this contributes to gastrointestinal illness. And as much as 51, or one study found that as much as 51% of gastrointestinal outbreaks resulted in the immediate days after a flooding event. So flooding is one of the climate change impacts that actually can cause communicable disease. And then lastly, I want to share with you about vector-borne disease. Our creepy crawly friends that are not quite friends in this aspect. So there are increased vectors. We've got these longer, hotter, warm seasons. And then geographically, their range is changing because they're able to inhabit areas of the Northeast where before, this was unheard of. Consider in Maine, they had maybe a dozen cases of Lyme disease, they had about a dozen cases of Lyme disease maybe 20 years ago. In 2012, they had over 1,100 cases of Lyme disease. So diseases that are brought to us by these insects and ticks are increasing and on the rise. Lyme disease, West Nile virus, and Zika virus, I think, is a really compelling story as we go forward. We've seen the images of children born with microcephaly to moms that were exposed to the Zika virus. So work needs to be done on a policy's perspective to stop the spread of these vector-borne diseases. But ultimately, we've got to address climate change. So the information that I shared with you today comes from 5 fact sheets that we have. They're on our webpage. You can download them. We've written these fact sheets. We've worked on them with with CDC and in consultation with the Frameworks Institute for actually research messages that will be more effective on audiences. You can download these. You can take and share them. They were written at an 8th grade reading level. They were written at an 8th grade reading level. So in hopes that we can take these and share these with most U.S. adults, and they'll be able to get some valuable information from it. We also have many infographics available on our website. This particular infographic that you see right here, we created it to coincide with the release of the U.S. Climate and Health Assessment that was released last year. APHA and Climate Nexus worked on this. We wanted to create some compelling images that had some factoids that would really draw people in. So what you see here is a summation of all of the infographics, but we also have these divided into their specific content areas. So we have one just on rising temperature, extreme weather, air quality, and vector-borne disease. And it's got great tidbits, great facts. We have found these to be so helpful for our use in social media because they're visually stimulating, I should say. So these are extremely helpful. They're available on our website. Once again, apha.org/climate. Please take and utilize our resources. And then I just give you a little bit of insight on some of our webinars that we have on these topics. We have just about 20 webinars available on our website. So any topic on climate change and health, if you want to delve more in depth, find out what's new in research, find out what people are doing in their communities to adapt. We've got a series ongoing right now with our Year of Climate Change and Health, and I'll share with you more information about that momentarily. So we have one coming up on May 22nd. This is going to be on air quality. We just had one on healthy community design, which has many policy impacts. And then also on clean energy, I want to highlight that we had a speaker from Citizens Climate Lobby, Dr. Rob Byron, spoke. So check out our webinars if you want to get a more in-depth understanding on some of the key topics of climate change and health. And so the Year of Climate Change and Health, it's happening right now. APHA launched the Year of Climate Change and Health in 2017. And the goals are to raise awareness by educating members that climate change is a public health issue, and then to also mobilize people to take action. So we've given them the tools of understanding, and then we want people to take action. So each month has a different theme. And Citizens Climate Lobby was very involved in March, which the theme was clean energy. So Dr. Lisa Del Bono created a blog post that you can also see on our webpage. And then, like I said, Dr. Rod Byron spoke on the webinar. We're so grateful to have had Citizens Climate Lobby as a partner in the Year of Climate Change and Health. And our partners can be organizations like Citizens Climate Lobby, or we can have individual partners, gold, silver, or bronze level. I am sure all of you are doing so much towards climate change. Some of the activities you can do as an individual partner are changing light bulbs, walking more, driving less, all the way up to attending marches and rallies, presenting at town hall meetings, calling your legislators. But you can learn more about becoming a partner at apha.org/climate. And with that, I'm glad to take any questions. Thank you so much for your time. I am so appreciative of this opportunity to speak to Citizens Climate Lobby once again. Happy to take questions. And I think that you all may also have my information if you want to follow up personally, natasha.djarnett@apha.org, or you can find me on Twitter @DrDJarnett. Thank you so much.
Cool. Yeah, thank you. So I'll have Ricky monitor the chat to see any questions coming in on the chat. But I wanted to start with if people wanted to find out the financial or monetary impact of the health-related impacts to climate change, what are the best resources to go to determine so that, you know, if we wanted to go to our member of Congress and say, you know, you could monetize this to be this many dollars in this state or this community, what would be the best way to go about that?
So I think that actually that is a really great way to go forward on climate change and health concerns, because I think that health is a compelling argument when it comes to this. Our health has to be the most important thing to us, because we love our families, we have strong faith, et cetera. We can't do any of that without health. So I think it's a very important argument, but quantifying this, there's really not very much on that out there, looking at it from a health benefit perspective. So we need health economists to come into the picture to help elucidate these. I wanted to share a website with you that actually looks at recent storms and quantifies the cost of those storms, like severe weather. And it actually even has some from 2017. I'm trying to figure out how to get to my screen. I'm in full screen here. Thank you so much. Yeah, yes. The website is www.ncdc.noaa.gov/billions/events. And I can also send this out through the chat. But you can actually look at each storm and see the cost. But looking at that from a benefit perspective, I think would be especially helpful to make a strong case.
Good. Ricky, are there any questions from the chat that you'd like to have Dr. DeJarnett respond to?
Yes. So a couple of, generally speaking, Dr. DeJarnett, do you feel like the link between climate change and health, is that apparent to most folks, or do you feel like there's still some education that needs to be done there?
I personally don't think it's apparent to most people. I can speak from the perspective of my family, for example. I was educated in this area, and so when I learn things, I go back and take it to them, and I'm excited. And they're like, huh, I never thought about that. And the more and more people that I talk to, I find that. So I started wearing my, we got climate change is health shirts at APHA now. So I wore my climate change is health shirt when I was traveling a couple weeks ago, and there was a lady at the restaurant. She said, what's that shirt say? I showed her. And I thought, she's a young lady. I would say she was probably less than 20. And so I started thinking I was teaching her something about climate change and health, but she actually threw knowledge back at me and said, oh, well, did you know this, this, and this? I think there's big opportunities with the younger generation. I think that's important so that we breed the next generation of professionals, be it health professionals or other, just a generation that is sensitive to the health impacts of climate, I think will go a long way. So I think there are some populations that are getting it and are certainly receptive to it, but I think there are some other populations that it's not quite on the radar. But taking every opportunity to make those connections, I think, are great. You've got communities that have high incidence of asthma and respiratory disease, and they have no idea that this is connected to climate change, or that climate change is one of the key culprits involved. And then you've got some communities that are dealing with for crime, for example. They've got significant crime going on. So climate change may not be the first thing that comes to mind when it's time to choose what to act on. And we do have to negotiate those issues as well.
Great. Ricky, we've got time for one more. Is there another one from the chat that you want to pick?
Yes, Peter Joseph asked, you know, what's your opinion about medical organizations adopting advocacy for a specific remedy to climate change, sort of like what, you know, what a doctor would do, right?
Yes, yes. We're all here for it. I'm personally all here for it. My organization is here for it as well. There are some excellent coalitions out there that are taking action. I'm sorry, medical coalitions that are out there taking action. The thing is, the medical profession, I think, are key because they are often the first responders. So, you know, a lot of what I said about the hospital, or I'm sorry, about the health impacts are, this results in more hospital visits for this. This results in more hospital visits for that. So they're the first responders. They see it there in their practices. So that's an opportunity, but also they're trusted voices. Between pastors and medical professionals, that's who people, you know, look to for their key advice. So being able to help patients make those connections, I think, is one thing. But then also they're a strong voice when they come together, and they're a large voice. I think the Medical Consortium on Climate and Health just released their report, but their constituency brings together like 400,000 medical professionals. That carries a lot with it when you go to advocate for something and say, I've got 400,000 people behind this that support this. And then I think nurses are especially helpful because they have been rated the most trusted profession. So having them on board, having them equipped, I think could go a long way in the space of being a trusted messenger as well.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And thank you for being so specific. You know, people talk about this generally, but thank you for getting into so much detail, you know, that gives us access to ways that we can talk about this. And you're certainly welcome to stand for the next 10 or 15 minutes. But if you have to drop off, we understand that also. And I do want to also say that one of our keynote speakers for this year's conference, Dr. Anthony Leiserwitz from the Yale 360 Project, who defined the six Americas, it's been his contention for quite some time that this is one of the avenues we can reach a lot of people, that this is an important message for us to be sharing with people.
I agree.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right, great. Thank you. Great. Ricky, could you free up Bill Bray's line in just a moment? I think most people know we have about 40 action teams in CCL. We have social justice. We have the Conservative Caucus. We've got faith. We've got health. Also, one of the things that we have is Team Oil, which is co-led by Bill Bray from Houston and also Liz Fisher. Bill's been a member of CCL. There they are. I think they're holding up the signs of those of them who are from the actual extraction industry. So you can see, yay. It's a great chapter down there. Bill's been a member since 2014 when he retired from Exxon, where he worked his entire career. He started the Woodlands chapter of CCL in 2015, which has now grown to three chapters in Texas' 8th District with over 400 members. Bill is also CCL's liaison to ExxonMobil and co-leads Team Oil. Also, if you ever go to Exxon's headquarters in Houston, you'll see that Bill has a patent that Exxon has up on the wall with his name on it. They work with the energy industry to further carbon fee and dividend to enable CCLers to better use oil and gas majors' explicit support of carbon pricing to increase our lobbying effectiveness. So, Bill, thank you so much for jumping on the call for a minute, and the floor is yours.
Thanks, Mark. First, I don't represent ExxonMobil now, but I do talk to their corporate greenhouse gas manager regularly and understand their position on climate change. Most of the oil majors publicly acknowledge climate change and support carbon pricing for a variety of good business reasons. They prefer a broad market-based approach to individual industry regulations and subsidies. They prefer a legislative solution to an administrative one, as it is longer term and will change less. Many majors like ExxonMobil prefer a revenue neutral carbon tax because it's simple, fair, transparent, and predictable. Statoil is the only company that attended the first meeting of the Climate Solutions Caucus, and they lobbied for a carbon tax. We, CCL, need to leverage the support of the oil majors. Individual CCLers might not agree on fracking, pipelines, or other issues, but CCL is laser focused on CF&D, and for this effort, they are our allies. This is a powerful lever, and we need to use it in both outreach and lobbying. To all your members of Congress, and cite examples of oil majors' support T-Mobile has lots of documentation, and there's